This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert.
This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Allegro Non Troppo is presented by Adam Stobbs, Peter Forty, and produced by Robert Brierley. Allegro is produced for the Community Radio Satellite Network at Melbourne radio station 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station since 1993.
This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network, coming out of station 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station in Melbourne, Victoria. And today Allegro is presented for you by Adam and John. Hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Adam.
Ethical considerations in sport, society and culture. Sport is part of the Australian way of life. We hear that all the time. But doesn't every culture claim this to be so? If so, then sport is an integral part of all communities, all cultures and all national identities.
So the question this week is sport actually that important to cultural development? Looking at the recent issues that face sport, it's hard to understand why it is so important.
Massive issues of sexual impropriety, the rugby league sex scandal, the stripper in the football club, the supposed cruelty of horse jumps racing, the list goes on.
It is universally accepted that sport is part of the process to healthy living for humans. It represents exercise, etc. However, the competitive nature can turn sport from healthy recreation into the most cold-blooded cruelty and barbaricism.
We will today discuss these issues with Rob Mitchell from the RJM Trust and probably the most appropriate person I could think of to come and do this show with us today. Welcome, Rob Mitchell.
Thanks for inviting me along, Adam.
It's always great to have you here. You're quite, just for the listener, could perhaps, it might be better if you describe yourself rather than me try to grasp at words and ideas.
Well, I mean, this all started purely by accident. I was the president of a country football club, and when they put me in there, they knew full well that I was obviously gay and that my partner was on the social committee as well. And for 99%, and I do mean 99% of the time, it wasn't a problem. And I mean, this was a small country town in regional Victoria. You know, it was obviously a bit of a first for them, but, you know, it was just went along really, really well. There were one or two people that seemed to have a problem with it, and that sort of started to cause a couple of problems, particularly at some social functions. And the first couple of times that the problems occurred, and they're pretty sort of what I'd call straightforward problems where people abuse you on the basis of your sexual orientation, I said, well, that's not on. And so through that process, it became obvious to me that the code, not just in regional areas, but Australian rules football, was completely clueless in dealing with discrimination based on sexual orientation.
And just from what I know of that particular issue that happened in that regional club, you're not the person to mess with, are you?
Well, it's not so much, I mean, as people will appreciate, and probably your older listeners will probably sort of, you know, clue into this particularly well, you get to a point in your life where you really sort of have to worry about what other people think of you and just live your life as you want to live it when you're not harming anybody else. You know, we all talk about the sort of ethereal, theoretical stuff about, you know, the Charter of Human Rights and all the UN stuff and so on. But on a day-to-day basis, our reasonable expectation, particularly in Australia, is that we can go about our business without being discriminated against. And so then I thought, well, how do we tackle this? Because the code was clueless on it. And my way of tackling this is to simply point it out in fairly sort of a direct fashion so that everybody knows what's going on. And the reason that works is, and this is really critical, that there is no broad community support for people being discriminated against in Australia on any basis.
Right. Okay. And so you're part of the champion of this cause to try and bring some reform.
Well, I'm probably providing a bit of colour and movement, but all I'm doing is really bringing to light the research that's been done for a number of years now by, you know, people like Dr. Carolyn Simons from Victoria University, Professor Anne Mitchell from La Trobe University, and Dr. Lynn Hillier. Now, this research has been going on for some period of time, and it points out in black and white that there's absolutely, you know, a critical link between discrimination that occurs, particularly against our young people who are same-sex attracted, and mental health issues further on, you know, depression and suicidal ideation further on down the track.
Most definitely. And through the years I've been teaching and indeed involved at this radio station, Shore 94.9, I've seen that happen so many times. So on behalf of the community, thank you for doing this. It's an important job.
Well, and thank you for people like you for airing it, because there's an old saying, sunlight is a great antiseptic. And if people know what's going on, that's the first step to actually getting the problem sorted.
And there are a lot of people listening to this broadcast, both locally and across Australian Community Radio Network. We're going to discuss the ethics and the social consequences of sport, because the last few weeks it's just blown out of the water completely. But there's a couple of disclaimers we need to make. The first one is, this conversation, this discussion to air, is by three men. We don't have a woman in here discussing it, so it's three men. And that's an important point to note, because our perspectives and life experiences may be slightly one-sided. We're also three homosexuals. I'm assuming you're homosexual,
yeah,
John. I thought you
was
might be.
Was last time I checked.
Okay, so we're also coming at this from...
And if I'm not, I'm giving it a good crack.
Yeah. I've had several of those myself lately. And that's also puts this discussion into context. However, the life experiences that we have had as homosexual men possibly might give us a slightly different perspective, and also gives us a slightly more, I hope, a slightly more objective insight. Our life experiences will probably give us a little bit of relation to these issues from our own experiences. I'm not going to say that we're particularly right, but I think we're possibly a little more sensitive on some of these issues from the discrimination and things that we faced in our own lives. Now, let's just have a look at some of the stories, first of all, that have been in the news in the last few weeks. And then we'll go and have a look at some of the bigger issues, how they translate philosophically across culture and society. The first thing that has been on everybody's lips, and it's just been such a huge sensation in the media that it pushed the budget off the front page of the newspaper. And that's this issue with the rugby league team in Sydney. Was it the Cronulla Sharks?
It was, a Matthew Johns, yes. And it was an event that happened some time ago.
It was. And it all came to a head when there was a Four Corners report on TV 2 weeks ago where Sarah Ferguson went over to New Zealand
with a couple of reporters. And I think this is, you know, what you've nailed it completely when you said, I can't remember an issue recently, any issue, but let alone a sports issue, that was capable of doing, as you said, knocking the budget off the front page. I mean, that was big news. And I think it's really important that we realise that, you know, this event was 7 years ago. Sarah Ferguson, a Four Corners reporter, went over there, did an interview with the young lady who was... who was engaged in group sex with some Cronulla Sharks rugby players, and really laid out in front of everybody what actually went on. Now, when the footy show, where Matthew Johns is currently working, got wind of this...
This is the Sydney NRL show.
Sydney NRL, yep. Not the Sydney NRL footy show. They launched a preemptive strike. I mean, the Four Corners report went to air on the Monday, and I think it was either Wednesday or Thursday prior when the footy show aired. They launched a preemptive strike with Matthew Johns going on air saying, effectively, look, this happened 7 years ago. It caused myself and my wife and my family a whole lot of pain. I'm deeply sorry for the pain that's been caused to them and also to the young lady. And that apology, you know, went on for about a minute. And at the end of it, his co-host patted him on the back and said, well done, Matty. Now, I've got to say, that would have to have been one of the most idiotic, blundering, preemptive strikes I've ever seen. And okay, I'm saying that with the benefit of hindsight, but there's another thing that happened after that I'll come back to a little bit later on, which indicates to me that they just don't get it.
Right.
They just don't get what actually happened. Now, of course, then we fast forward and the Four Corners program goes to air, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I'm saying, well, it was a body blow, not only to the Cronulla Sharks, but also to the NRL as a code.
just back up a little bit. So Matty Johns went to air before the Four Corners show went to air.
That's right. He went on
so
air.
So he had wind of what was coming up.
Yes, because Sarah Ferguson had contacted Matthew Johns. In fact, Sarah Ferguson contacted a whole lot of people prior to the story going to air on the ABC on Four Corners. And Sarah Ferguson made a point of saying something. She said of all the people that she contacted, not one of them asked how the young woman was.
Oh.
Now, you know, the words have got to match the music, don't they?
I think so.
On the one hand, they on the preemptive strike, he's very apologetic. And I know we don't want to focus on one person's, you know, sexual activities, but, you know, if they were genuinely remorseful, would they not say to the reporter, how's she going?
Maybe they were too scared to admit by saying something like that. That might have admitted some sort of liability. Because the thing that's come out, see, and in these sorts of incidents, the first casualty is the truth. None of us were in there, in that room. None of us really know what happened. We don't really know. We're getting conflicting stories of what actually happened. Who did what? Who said what? And what was the incidents and the follow-up events? You know, was, did she boast about it? God, I had a good time. Or did she come out of there feeling as though she'd been raped? What really happened? We'll probably never know.
Well, look, we won't. And you're right. Some people have obviously taken the view that this young lady waited 7 years to raise this. So I guess we'll generate sort of two polarised points of view. You've got the Matthew Johns supporters on one side who are saying things like, she gave informed consent. It's been 7 years since the issue was raised. Why is it being raised now? And those sorts of trains of argument. On the other side, you've got people saying, well, look, this is just not acceptable. You know, how was the young woman at 19 going to give informed consent? And if she did consent to the first person, did the rugby players who were lined up behind Matthew Johns, and I understand Matthew was the first one to have sex with her, if they were lined up behind him, metaphorically, if not physically, did they all say words to the effect of, to this young woman, do you mind if I have sex with you?
Mm.
Now, as you say, we weren't there. Now, we can form, you know, ideas based on our own experience about what's going on, and I think it's common ground that there was alcohol involved as well, so people's, you know, judgment of being impaired and so on. My issue with the Matthew Johns supporters is, on the one hand, you're armchair experts on informed consent, okay, because they're saying, well, you know, she consented and so on. But in the same breath, they seem to conveniently forget that there's no statute of limitations on the allegation of rape. So you think, well, there are either a whole lot of bush lawyers who, you know, don't know what they're saying, or has the polarisation been generated by people who are self-interested in not only pumping up rugby league, but also pumping up the footy show?
Okay. Let's just back up. There's an interesting issue here where you said informed consent. And I've been hearing that a lot over the last few weeks. Now, informed consent, there is no benchmark that says this person is capable of informed consent. We have an age of consent. But we don't have any way to test whether people can actually make informed decisions about what they get involved with, okay? I'm a teacher, and I know some 15-year-olds that I think they're completely capable of making informed decisions about their own lives on certain things. And I know some 15-year-olds who are sexually active, and I wish they weren't, but they are, and I don't particularly have a problem with that, even though it's against the law. I know that they're intelligent, articulate, they are fully aware of what they're doing. By the same token, I know some 45-year-olds who are out there having sex who do not have the maturity to be able to make an informed decision about what they're doing. And they get themselves into some hideous situations. They get pissed. They take substances. They have no idea where they are, what they're doing. So this basis of an informed consent, there's no benchmark. It's all an individual thing.
Subjective.
It's very subjective. And so you can't really use informed consent as a benchmark to say she gave informed consent. Was she actually capable of making informed decisions? What about the rugby league players? They were obviously off their faces.
Well, and that's, we don't know. And I'm just giving them, I'm just being, you know, I'm just a bit of devil's advocate here because we weren't there. And I'm saying, well, okay, maybe they were stone cold sober. Let's pursue that proposition. They were stone cold sober. They weren't on drugs. They were in complete control of their faculties, right? They're all of majority age, and they all thought it was a great idea to have, you know, pack sex, not group sex, pack sex with a 19-year-old female who was drunk.
Mm.
How does that sit?
Yeah, that's terrible, isn't it?
Okay, so that's that proposition. The other proposition is, you know, as you say, well, okay, they were drunk and or drugged. Okay. They, again, had pack sex with this young 19-year-old woman. And then, okay, well, they can say, look, I didn't really know what I was doing.
Can you really argue diminished responsibility when there were so many of them?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to pretend to be a lawyer. Yeah. I'm just going to say...
It's more of a rhetorical question.
I think we've just got to say, well, look, you know, if it was B rather than A, okay, so they were, you know, drunk or whatever, didn't really know what they were doing, then why haven't they come forward? You know, and this, you know, we talk about, there's a word I think that probably hasn't raised its head yet, but I think we've got to spell out, you know, pretty succinctly, and that's hypocrisy. I mean, you know, so much of the code is about supporting your teammates and, you know, sort of a group effort on the sporting field. Who's hanging Matthew Johns out to dry? Is it the Australian community or is it his fellow teammates?
Indeed. Well, there's the question, you know, that they keep bringing up is what happens on tour stays on tour, which is why the others...
And with all due respect to anybody who's offended by this language, that is self-serving crap. I mean, that is just really... that's a variation of, if you don't know about this, you won't be worrying about this. And that's the real... Look, you know, the real thing that really struck me about this whole thing, you know, you've got the sort of the intensity of their response and it's just been pervasive in the media. They've all talked about it. What's happened is a woman's gone over there, Sarah Ferguson, with a couple of production people.
We need to look at why did they do this in the first place.
Yeah. And you know...
What
were they hoping to achieve? And the proposition I'm going to put to you is that this is part of a systemic problem. It's part of the culture or part of the furniture, and this has been an opportunity for sunlight to be put on this particular issue. And I believe that the events that have unfolded since this interview was done and aired support that view, because if there was a heap of people saying, oh, look, you know, and I'm sort of, you know, paraphrasing, that she deserved all this or she asked for it, then there wouldn't have been the depth of response that there's been.
Okay. It's possibly about ratings. It's been a fabulous story. It's been so successful for Four Corners. The media have all grabbed on it because it's made such a huge issue out of it. I don't want to trivialise the issue. It is a serious issue.
If you were a friend of that girl and she had come to you and said 7 years ago I was pack raped by a group of guys, would you take her to the media or would you take her to a police station?
If she'd been pack raped, rape is sex without consent.
Mm.
She wasn't raped. Mm. She consented. She had ended up having more sex. Look, I don't know what I would do, actually. And I don't want to go down the path of finding anything humorous in this issue because it's so easy to, but it's really, really serious. And where I'd like to take our conversation now, Rob Mitchell, is to this particular event. It has occurred and we can see the fallout and the consequences of this. Now, the Pran Football Club had a female stripper in the... And this has just come on the back of this, and this is now blown up as well, although it seems to be pushed off the pages a little bit now. It seems as though this sort of using testosterone and sex to rev up teams and bring them together, it's part of sporting culture. It's a bit hypocritical. We'll look at the hypocritical double standard in a moment, but you work in this environment. Tell us.
Well, I think that probably, you know, given that what's gone on, I mean, I don't know whether the Paran Football Club knew what they would, or knew of the Matthew John stuff when they booked the stripper.
Okay.
It wasn't good timing. I think that's probably the best angle that you can put on it. But it seems to me that I would put that in a different category. I'd put that more into the, it's stupid. And yes, you can certainly draw the conclusion that, you know, throughout all levels of male team sports, that a lot of that sort of testosterone charge bonding, and in fact, in the rugby league case, they talk about, you know, that sex was used, you know, not now they say, but, you know, in the past, for, you know, pulling the teammates closer together and using that as a bonding exercise.
How?
Well, I mean, that's obviously.
I mean, that's ridiculous. If that's one of their philosophical and one of their stratagem, that is absolutely ridiculous. How can you use sex to pull together a team of men? Please explain.
Well, obviously, they think that it has worked. Now, you know, that may be, as I believe, I just believe it's an excuse, okay, yeah. Because, you know, and it seems to be something peculiar to male team sports. But you've got to say, you've got to take a step back and say, well, look, you know, why is it occurring? And at some level, there's agreement, not explicit agreement, you know, but at some level, people are sort of saying, well, okay, look, we've done this in the past and it hasn't come around to bite us in the bum, so we'll keep doing it. Okay. Now, you know, I think that the wake-up call, you know, you would hope that the wake-up call has now been given, although I sort of do wonder, you know, what it's going to take. But it seems to be that this is something that is peculiar to, you know, male-dominated team sports, where there's a lack of women involved in the administration at the higher levels.
That sounds like a very good analysis. Mind you, saying that this is all part of the bonding experience or whatever sounds like a really flimsy background excuse to me.
It's convenient.
It's convenient, it is indeed. So what does this tell us about the whole issue of male team sports? Now, let's look at this professional and amateur, right? But the difference is the professional ones. The thing I've got a problem with here, Rob Mitchell, and you can shed some light into this, is that look at the wider philosophical issue that team sport brings out male aggression.
And it's an opportunity to act out the aggression in a way that's culturally acceptable.
Okay. And to get this sport up to peak performance, they use the aggression, they enhance and focus the aggression and make it even stronger.
And they do, and it's rewarded. And in fact, on the Four Corners report, the fellow from one of the trainers, one of the coaches, I think, from the NRL said, look, you know, that's one of our core problems here is that on the field, we get these young men, we crank them up, you know, they're physically at their peak, they're motivated, they're welded in that every sense, you know, they're welded together into a team, and they're risk takers.
Yep.
So, you know, that's what we want. You know, that's what they're the attributes that we reward, and they are rewarded.
They get loads of money.
They get loads of adulation.
And they get status. They get power.
And in this context, they get those things that they would never get in any other profession.
And then we put them into the community and into society, and we expect them to behave like angels. So we give them all of this. We rank up they rank up their aggression to this particular point. They're running high on testosterone aggression. They've got lots of money. Everybody loves them. They can't do anything wrong. And most of them are in their 20s. Maybe early 30s, and they just don't have the life experience or skills to be able to handle that amount of power and that amount of energy that they've got. And they run off the rails, and what do? Crucify them.
We crucify them, but we also do something actually much worse. And consider this. In the state of Victoria alone, there's 70,000 players in the Victorian Country Football League, not in the Metropolitan Amateur League, but just in the Country League. So there's more than 130,000 football players in Victoria. Now, what percentage of them do you reckon want to play at the elite level?
I would say a lot of them.
That's right. Now, we've got 770 elite players in the AFL. So there's a supply and demand inequity.
Yes.
So there's, on the supply side, literally, there's an endless stream of them, and they only want, you know, obviously a lot less than 770 per year.
I think we've quite nicely identified and drawn into perspective some of the real issues to do with this. Quickly before we go on, we're going to have a music track and something in a moment. Just beforehand, I just wanted to touch on the double standards of society. So we have this football club. They have a female stripper that goes in, okay? And everybody's going, oh, that's terrible, that's awful and everything. And I spoke to several women. I work in a place where there's a lot of women. And I said, if your husband goes to a strip joint, you know, what do you think? Oh, that is so sleazy, that's awful. I said, okay, how many times have you all gone out and you've been to an all-male review when you've been to one of these hens nights where they have male strippers? Oh, all the time. I said, are you sleazy and disgusting because you go there? No, we're not. Okay, so it's a bit of a double standard. But one of them did make a very interesting comment. She says, but the way the male strippers behave
is much different
to the female strippers. However, let me say, a few years ago, I went out to one of these big suburban family restaurants, and there was some hens night was there, and a male stripper came in, and they were off to the one side, and I did see the male stripper naked, completely naked. He lay the woman down on the floor, and then he was doing push-ups above her with his private parts sort of going up and down into her face. So that was the most extreme thing. I have seen female strippers, which wasn't, let me tell you, it was quite a traumatic experience for me, being a middle-aged homosexual, performing acts and doing things which were just so full-on suggestive, and it was sort of come and get it sexuality. So I do take the point that perhaps female strippers use a different technique to titillate their audience. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo here on the Community Radio Network with Adam and John. Our special guest today is Rob Mitchell. What we're doing today is we're looking at some of the social consequences and ethics in sport, as has been in the press over the last few weeks. There's been quite a lot of stories, not just all of the sex scandals and strippers, but also jumps racing. Now, I consulted with a friend of mine about jumps racing because she races and she breeds racehorses, and she absolutely loves horses. She loves them. She's got a lot, and she's very well known, and she's very well respected in her field. And I was asking her about jumps racing. So we'll just have a little bit of a chit-chat about jumps racing. There's two types of horse racing where the horses have to jump. The steeplechase, and there's jumps racing, which is, they're like hurdles, okay? And there's been a lot of anguish in the community lately because some of the horses have tripped and broken their legs, and they've had to be put down. Do you have any comment about jumps racing before I launch into my triad?
Well, no. When you first contacted me to come on the program, and you were telling me that story, and I also was speaking to a friend of mine after I spoke to you, who is very horsey, you know, who likes horses, and she said to me, "Well, look, you know, I understand that some people have a problem with it, but if it's done properly, and the animals are prepared, and the jumps are properly manufactured and maintained, that the experience overseas has been that the problem rate that they have is very, very low."
So my friend had just been to France, and she saw 16 jumps races in one afternoon. With one of them, she said, had a huge field of 30 horses, which is unheard of, so many horses in a race. And she said there was not one accident, not one. She said to me, if the horses are trained properly, if the course is laid out properly, and a lot of thought and preparation goes into it, and it's done safely, she says, fine. She said, now, lowering the height of the jumps is not a particularly good idea, or putting a water trough in front or a little moat in front of it, the jump, is not a good idea. The horses have to jump high to clear them. And she said also removing a jump in the straight, so they have the jumps and then they have a straight to race, putting a jump near the end. She says the horses are running and they suddenly have to break their canter to get into a slightly different position to get over the last jump. She said that's really bad practice. So I said to her, what happens then? So if, say, a horse does fall, and she said, well, shoot it. I said, but you know, this horse is, yeah. She said, it's just a horse, shoot it. And I started to think, I said, isn't that cruel? She said, no. These horses are bred for this purpose. They're trained for this purpose. If they can't perform this purpose, shoot it. She said, you might think it's cruel and everything. She said, but there's not one scrap of evidence to suggest that this horse is any more aware than any other animal. It's just an animal. It's not aware that even hardly that it's alive. So she said, shoot it. I was somewhat taken aback by that.
Well, it's pretty confronting, but I mean, I can sit here and say, well, look, it's terrible and that we should stop jump racing and, you know, it's cruel to the animals. And originally when I was thinking about this, that was my first reaction. I live on a farm. It's probably useful for your listeners to know that I drive out the driveway every morning on my way to work, and as I'm driving past, On the left-hand side, there's some state forest, and on the right-hand side, there are my paddocks. And as well as running beef cattle and a couple of token gay alpacas, there's an uninvited group of kangaroos that, chew the feed down.
A lot of them?
Yeah, a lot of them. And I mean, depending upon how their other food sources are going, their numbers will go up and down. Now, in the past, well, that's being a bit hypocritical. I mean, it's not uncommon for me to think I must organise for somebody to come out and cull them because I don't have my shooter's licence.
Right. You get somebody in to come and shoot the kangaroos.
Yeah, and you get someone to cull them. And I'm just wondering whether perhaps that's any different than shooting horses.
Well, I guess that they're wild kangaroos, where these horses are specifically bred for this racing, and we're sort of saying, well, if you're not good enough for this, then we'll shoot you.
I don't think it's a question of not good enough. It's just a question of if they're damaged and not able to perform. They don't want to pay for the recovery, and then the horse can't ever race again. So what do they do with it? Now, my friend also said to me, she said, horses are probably one of the mistreated, and she said, animals around. She said, and it's not the horses that you see going and racing and stuff like that. She said, there are a lot of places, if you just drive out and have a look, particularly in the outer suburban areas of metropolitan areas, you'll see horses that are just left in the paddock. They don't get any training. They don't get looked after properly. And she said, it's a disgrace. She said, it's a real disgrace. Horses are probably the most mistreated animals of all.
And part of the reason for that is the cost of feeding them. Mm. Because the cost of, as the drought has obviously hit across Australia, the cost of food has gone up, whether it's oats or any of the other grains. So, what maybe started out as a fairly inexpensive birthday present is basically left in a paddock, as you say, on the outer suburbs. And, they're not looked after. They're not exercised. They're not, vets are expensive. So, all the sort of normal things that you would do to look after a horse get pushed on the back burner simply because there's not enough money available.
Are we making these animals perform for our own entertainment, for things that they're not supposed to do? Horse racing, trots, jumps racing, steeplechase, and all of the other sports where you have playing polo.
But isn't there a trend here? I mean, over the last 20, 30, 40 years, hasn't there been a real shift in community expectation about how animals are treated? And I mean circuses, zoos?
There has over the last 400 years. Let me give you an example. One of the great bastions of social modern thinking, Sir Thomas More, who died for his principles, okay? He was beheaded because he would not allow Henry VIII to be the head. He wouldn't agree to Henry VIII being the head of the Anglican Church, the Church in England. He went to have his head chopped off because he stood up for what he thought was ethically and morally correct. Yet Sir Thomas More used to brag about how he was one of the top people at playing a sport called cock stealing. And what they do in cock steal is they get a rooster and they put they tie it around the neck with a length of rope, right? About a meter. And then they use these very heavy wooden sticks and they throw these sticks at the cock, and the first thing they try and do is break the legs, and then they bash it to death with the, and this was a huge sport, everybody loved it, okay? This was a time of Sir Thomas More, and there have been even worse sports, badger baiting, all of these sports where they basically make animals suffer. Look at cockfighting that they do in other countries, where they get these, they get cocks and they put these razor blades on their legs so they can rip each other to shreds. Now, you translate this barbarianism into human sport. Look at the Olympic sport of boxing. Mm. Now, it's awful. It's awful. Can you tell me what is boxing? Is it skill? Perhaps there is some skill in learning the moves and the agility that's required. But at the end of the day, what is it?
Okay, well, this is where Adam and I are obviously going to part company because I actually think that boxing is completely different because I actually think boxing is skilled. Now,
I'm not saying it's not, but what is it?
Okay, well, let me continue. It is skilled. They're certainly very well physically trained. I think that they do take reasonable precautions in terms of their headgear and so on, in terms of the medical attention that's there when they're fighting. Now, boxing is a sport that some people choose, and that's the word that I'm using deliberately, choose to involve themselves in. Now, the fact that you and I'm not particularly amused to it, or I don't think, you know, I'm not going to go and start boxing, particularly at 45. But I mean, it's not something that I see as being in the same league as cockfighting. I mean, I don't see how, if you've got animals that are just basically being, you know, forced to be in a situation where there's a fight to the death, I don't think that's a product of a civilized human society. Now, I put great contrast between animals fighting one another at the behest of humans, than humans fighting one another because, you know, humans do lots of things that are injurious to their health, whether it's cigarette smoking, whether it's, you know, their diet. I mean, you know, and the phrase nanny state is used. It seems to me that so much of this is dependent upon what society thinks of, you know, at the particular time as to, you know, what the community expectation is.
I tend to disagree with you. No matter what skill and anything's involved in boxing, it's basically hurting somebody else for pleasure and sport.
Two men beating each other up.
Yeah. Let's not get confused with World Championship Wrestling, because that's more like a drag show without the drag. Okay? Yeah. The ones that I see. That's just a parody, really, isn't it?
It is. And
but I can't stand watching it either.
Okay. But there are some sports. Now, look at fencing. Fencing is a sport, okay?
We're really parting company now, because, I mean, fencing to me...
But where did it come from? What is it?
Well,
it's about using a weapon to kill another person. We don't do that now, but there's skill. So it's the evolution. So why can't sport evolve like fencing did? I quite like watching fencing. I don't see the aggression in it so much because it's become a civilized sport. There's no hurting involved.
Okay, well then we can now, we're about to hit on, you know, one of the golden truths, and we say, okay, fencing has evolved, hasn't it, over hundreds of years. You know, it's evolved from a sport that, you know, started out killing people, and I don't, you know, and somebody can maybe tell us, but I'm struggling to think of any, you know, fatal injuries due to fencing, certainly in Australia, and it may not be the most popular of sports here. But it seems to me that that sport is one of a whole host of sports.
Like archery.
It seems to me that fencing and archery are a number of sports, you know, in the majority of sports, that are capable of continuously resynchronizing themselves, not only with what's going on or what's required legislatively,
but adapting to social standards.
Is that happening with the two biggest examples of male team code sport in Australia, which is rugby league and AFL?
I propose that it's actually going the other way, that is becoming more brutalized. I mean, look at grand final, AFL grand final. And I have to say, I'm guilty here. I walk past sort of with mild disinterest of what's happening when it's on the TV. But if they're having this big punch-up, I stand and watch.
Mm.
Why? Why am I drawn to the fact that there's...
Well, presumably the same reason that people went to the Coliseum.
Exactly. And we did have a message from one of our listeners, from Don in Paran, who said that a lot of these sports are a replacement for what happened in the Colosseum. It's interesting, isn't it, that humans are drawn to watch this sort of conflict. So we're hardwired to be able to watch this. But let's get back to the team thing, because I think we're going to have a paradigm shift in the whole cultural aspect of the way team sports with all of these men.
Well, I think, you know, and it's interesting, I was at a dinner that Andrew Demetriou was speaking at a few months ago. And Andrew Demetriou, who, you know, most people know, is the head of the AFL. And he was clearly very passionate and very proud about the forward steps that have been taken by the AFL in combating things like racism, the respect and responsibility program that they run for women. And after the dinner, I sort of thought about what he said, and I've had this ongoing battle with the AFL to get them to introduce, along with their racial and religious vilification policies, stuff to do with the men who aren't straight in the AFL, so, you know, to afford them the same protection, because there are 350-odd men playing elite AFL football who are under 24, and the La Trobe University research tells us that 35, or roughly 10% of them, won't be straight, and so they should be looked after. And so, in the same way that there's the Indigenous players there, they should be looked after. And that would send a really clear message to young men and women across Australia in the community who aren't straight, that it's not okay for them to be vilified, you know, at school or at sport, which is where most of the vilification occurs. But I think the core problem is, if we go back to the archery and the fencing, that is continually changing. It seems to me that the biggest problem that the NRL have and the AFL have is they don't have any capacity for critical self-evaluation.
Right.
They don't have, it seems to me, the ability to work out for themselves. Epiphanies are light on at the AFL, Adam.
So where does this change come from? Now, just look at this. One of the most straightest bastions, you would think, of male sexuality, which is absolutely completely done a 360-degree turn, a 180-degree turn, and has become completely enlightened, is the army. The armed forces. We had some soldiers in a few weeks ago for Anzac Day who are gay and they're part of a support network. And I said, so what are the problems? And he said, well, there aren't any.
Yeah.
It's completely fine, open, no problem. They don't get any harassment, anything. If the army
can do it,
then the AFL...
And what's the word? What's the one word, the magic word? And I'll give you another great example here in Victoria. The Victorian Police. Remember what the relationship used to be like between the gay and lesbian community and the Victorian Police?
Yep.
It used to be a train stack. Yep. And Christine Nixon came along. And the magic word is leadership.
Leadership and motivation. Yep. If the leadership is not willing to take it, and sounds like the AFL doesn't really have that leadership, the coercion needs to come from where the money comes from.
That's it. That's exactly right. And you're starting to see that now. You saw it the first time I sort of saw it, started to get some traction was when in Victoria here, and the Footy Show, it was a Victorian version of the Footy Show, where Sam Newman had the doll of Carolyn Wilson. And there was a big uproar about that because it was generally agreed that Sam's behaviour on the Footy Show was quite derogatory towards Carolyn Wilson, who was a very well-respected female football journalist. In fact, one of the the first football journalists who was female to really make inroads there. And one of the major sponsors of the Footy Show in Victoria is the ANZ Bank. And there was talk about getting onto the ANZ Bank and pointing out that a lot of the people that had ANZ Bank accounts and consequently a lot of the people that the ANZ make money out of are women. And very quickly, Sam Newman had a sabbatical and went off to get some counselling. Now, we've seen it more recently played out with the Matthew Johns incident, again with the Cronulla Sharks. A major sponsor, LG, have said, OK, you can kiss goodbye to $700,000 a year. So for the Cronulla Sharks, who are carrying debt of somewhere north of $10 million, life's not so good because it's gone. John Simons, the head of Aussie Home Loans, has also said to the NRL as a code, because Aussie Home Loans are a big sponsor of the code itself. He's had a meeting with them and he's made it crystal clear that unless things change, they can kiss goodbye to that sponsorship as well. So, you know, I really think that's where we've got to concentrate our efforts, because with all the social networking that we have with Facebook, with Twitter, with things like MySpace and so on, very quickly people can get organised. And that's what I think we've got to do. The AFL alone turns over more, just the AFL, the $370 million a year. Now, that code also puts its hand out for $400,000 a year from the Australian Sports Commission, which is, as part of their funding agreement, is purely for the grassroots development of the code. And for some reason, they can't even get together, you know, a few pages in their member protection policy to look after young men and women who aren't straight. And we've got to be saying as a community, that's simply not good enough.
Right. So this is where the leadership is not following through, but it by getting the sponsors on board or the sponsors getting off board may elicit some sort of change.
Look, there's no may about it. If we look at LG, how do you think they've been travelling over the last 12 months with the economic crisis stroke? I mean, they've got some real problems. They're going to be very sensitive to anything that they sponsor is not completely squeaky clean. Ditto with Toyota, which is a major sponsor of the AFL. Now they've had their first loss of $6 billion in 60 years.
Yes.
That's what we need to be telling Toyota.
So I think we're coming to that point, aren't we? We're coming to the tipping point. I don't think we're quite there yet.
No, we are well on the way when an Australian, okay, granted it's four corners, we're well on the way to the tipping point when a film crew does one piece about an event that's 7 years old and it's a body blow to the NRL as a code.
Mm.
They are hollow men, Adam.
Yeah, they are hollow men. Indeed. It's been interesting to follow this conversation through and to see how male aggression. Now, I just wanted to acknowledge women's sport. They have women's boxing as well. So women's sport has just the same level of aggression and things like that. But for some reason, it doesn't have the language. You don't hear the language of aggression. You know, when you're preparing teams and things like that, they use words, we're not going to win. They want to win at any cost. We're going to kill them. We're going to slaughter the opposition. It's the very language, the whole ethos about how we prepare for competitive sport.
And also what you pointed out before, we've got these young men who, you know, come from vastly different socioeconomic backgrounds into team sports that are highly well paid. I mean, you know, they really are an accident waiting to happen. And the way to avoid that is to make sure that the appropriate support networks are in place for them. And not just, you know, lip service.
Look, let's look at the greater thing with the Olympics. The Olympics originally were, I think, based on gladiatorial sports, weren't they?
Yeah.
The Olympics. So now they say that the Olympic sport, the Olympic Games are about sport. And my opinion is bullshit. The Olympic sport is 2 weeks at the end of a four-year cycle. Granted, there are a lot of athletes in training. The Olympic Games is about power. It's about prestige. It's about media ratings. It's about selling things and getting people sucked in. It just happens to be sport at the end of it.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. But what you're talking about there is a sort of commoditization or packaging of sport. And that's been the big change in the last 20 or 30 years, not just with AFL and not just with NRL. It's all gone from sort of community-based sporting clubs into a mega business. And it is a mega business. When you look at those figures that they quote on the contracts that are written for broadcasting for AFL and NRL and all this sort of ancillary stuff that flows from it, they're mega numbers. And unfortunately, what's not taken into account in that process is at the end of all this, there are people. And unless we as a community start to impress upon the custodians, okay, so the AFL and the NRL don't own the sport. We as a community own the sport. They are the custodians of it. And on balance, given recent events, I'd be lucky from me anyway to pull a C-grade average.
Okay. Rob Mitchell, last thing I want to just talk about is probably a little bit of a let's tell some of our tales of horror. Is my worst experience with group male sports is two. I've had one was when I was boarding school. They forced me. I used to hide in the toilets and all sorts of things because I didn't mind playing sport. I didn't want to play in a team. And I was forced to play hockey. Right? And I mean physically forced to play hockey. Second hockey game, I broke one of my own teammates' nose with a hockey stick. I just got sick of the poofter taunting.
Yep.
And I smacked him in the face really hard with a hockey stick.
Yep.
And after about 3 weeks, I was expelled for being too aggressive. Okay. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about, and I'm quite sure a lot of our listeners, and I'm sure you, Rob Mitchell, have been in this situation, you've been on an aeroplane, possibly on a long-haul flight, with a group of sports people.
Yep.
All males who've been all together. I was on one of the cheaper airlines, Australian Airlines, some not that long ago, with a team that was travelling from the Gold Coast, and the poor flight crew were beside themselves of trying to keep them calm. And there was a football flying up and down the cabin, and I'll never forget the man next to me. He says, you could see that I was quite distressed because the number of times the ball nearly hit me, and you'd have these guys, aggressive, loud, drunk, running up and down the plane. And he said, oh, it's just blokes being blokes. I thought, oh, well, I'm a male, I'm a bloke, and I don't act like that. He was actually more traumatised than me. So when it's thrown into our face in society, perhaps more people need to experience that and they'll understand what we're talking about. Rob Mitchell, it's been great to have you on Allegro Non Troppo. I don't know that I've got a conclusion for all of this because I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I think the answer is that with sport, clear leadership is required. There are some sports like surf lifesaving, which used to be incredibly hetero, incredibly white, that's been transformed with effective leadership.
Is our culture and society moving forward to more enlightenment in sport?
Slowly, but steadily.
Why is it such an important part of our life?
Because we were dumped here a few hundred years ago. We didn't have a lot of dough. What started out as communities getting together and participating in something that provided them with social connectedness and the ability to forget their day-to-day problems has been bastardized in a lot of respects in the name and the pursuit of money. And what do you do, Adam, when you're faced with people who are driven totally by money?
I think that's part of just about every section of our society, and the part of it being part of our culture. I think every culture claims to have sport as an integral part of their way of life. Rob, it's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Adam,
for joining us on Allegro Non Troppo. Rob Mitchell of the RJAM Trust. You need to fix your website up. All it says is Idaho.
It's under construction, and we did a thing for Idaho, and it will resume transmission shortly.
Okay, so if you'd like to find out more, you have a look at the Allegro homepage. It's allegro.org.au. Thank you, John, for being on Allegro this week. We see you next week?
It's been a pleasure. I will be back next week.
Okay, we'll be back with Allegro on the Community Radio Network next week. Bye, everyone.